Okay, see, good morning. So the talk for today is to continue with understanding Riemann integrable functions and try to get a little bit bigger class of functions that are Riemann integrable. I'll actually state the theorem, although we're not going to prove it or even actually get a complete statement of a complete classification, which does exist. But mostly we're just going to build some more and then move on to the fundamental theorem of calculus, where, you know, the fact that integrals and derivatives are inverse to each other, which was, of course, the reason that we introduced integrals to begin with. Okay, so let me just recall where we were as far as functions that are Riemann integrable, and then add another theorem that will allow us to get more Riemann integrable functions. Okay, so first of all, Riemann integrable functions. Okay, so what we knew from previously was 11.28 and 11.30 gave us a list of functions that are Riemann integrable. So our continuous functions on AB are Riemann integrable. And 11.30, we had that the increasing function is Riemann integrable. Okay, but this didn't cover everything. Let's see, I guess 11.44, we had that f is Riemann integrable if only if the restrictions are. And that's handy, we'll make use of that. But there were even some, but we had other examples and they don't actually fit into here. And so we're gonna add at least a few more ways to build functions. And so the other example, for example, is from the homework, the Tome function. Actually, I think I have a picture of it. Yeah, so this thing, so this is the one that you saw in the homework, the Tome function, which is zero at irrational points and non-zero at rational points, but the values get smaller, like you can see from this picture, they kind of concentrate around the bottom there, and you manage to show that one actually has zero, is in fact Riemann integrable with a zero integral. But if we take that the rational points and put the value one at all the rational points, then we know it's not. So again, that's a sort of an indication of the borderline between functions that are integrable and ones that are not. So the Tome function from the homework was the function, let me call it T for Tome, T of x. So that was one on n if x is equal to a over n. And zero otherwise. Okay, and this you showed was a Riemann integrable. And 0, 1, I guess. But if you take the function, the characteristic function on Q, let me call it chi Q of X, which is a one, if X is A over N and zero otherwise, this one is not Riemann integrable. Okay, so that gives you some sort of indication of the difference between them. And one way to understand, let me add a couple more functions. So question functions that we will cover in this class, and then I will try to give at least a hint as to what differentiates these functions. So actually, can anyone think of a function that we've seen already, that we've used quite a bit, but we don't know yet whether it's integrable from what we have here? So it'd have to be something that's not continuous, it's not increasing. But it is bounded. Well, let me try the following. So the one that I have in mind is this the sign of one of X. Right, so that one, we can graph it. And the point is that it oscillates very quickly as it approaches zero. Okay, so it has it's a continuous except at zero, and at zero it has a problem. Okay, so that's a classic function that we considered when we were looking at differentiability, and we can similarly consider it for integrability. Okay, and is f of x integrable? Okay, and here, let me give you one that's a little bit worse still. So let's take a g of x to be. All right, so I'm going to, so this one has that singularity at zero. I can put a singularity everywhere this one has one. So let me take g of x to be the sine, not of 1 over x, but of 1 over f of x. So the sine of 1 over x. Okay, and zero otherwise. And of course, this makes sense as long as x is not equal to 1 over n pi, which is where sine of 1 over x is zero, or zero, of course. And zero otherwise. So this function is going to have problems, singularities, where it's not continuous at every place that the function above with zero, so it's gonna be harder to draw, but it's gonna get rapid around each of these points. Okay, it's really hard to draw, but I hope you have some idea what I'm talking about. Feel free to ask questions if it's not clear. Okay, and we can ask the same question. This function g here a Riemann integrable function? Okay, and I'd like to answer those two questions. In fact, I'm going to ask you to answer the second one. So keep in mind the theorems we're looking at now, and you can try to figure out how to show that that one is, in fact, Riemann integrable. But before I write down the theorem, let me just note something here. The point here is going to be that the main point of these, the main distinguishing feature of these functions is where they have singular points, where they're not continuous. So if we write DISC, because that's what's important here for the discontinuous points, well, x such that f is discontinuous at x, not continuous at x, right? So then we have these discontinuities. Of course, if so, in other words, just I hope the notation is clear. So if f is continuous, then of course there aren't any. That's just the empty set. But if I take, for example, f up above, the sine of 1 over x, is it clear what disk of that function is?
Just zero?
Exactly. Okay, so does everyone see that? So that's the single point at which that function is discontinuous. Okay. And let me try to do that now for the other three functions up here. I'd like to look at where the discontinuities are for G, where they are for the characteristic function on Q, so the function that's one on values that are rational and zero on all the rest, and for this Tome function. Okay, and all three have different sets of discontinuous points, and that's really what is playing the most important role here. So if g is above, let's see, is it clear where this one is discontinuous? I don't think my drawing did justice to the function. So what's happening is that at each of these points, yeah, exactly. It's actually one on n pi, right? So it's every place where this thing starts to bunch up, and that's where I'm plugging in zero here into the denominator. And for that to be zero, I have to plug in n pi into here, which means that x has to be 1 over n pi. Okay. These are places where it's going to be discontinuous. So it's the set of all 1 over n pi. And it's also discontinuous at zero. Okay, so those are the places where it's discontinuous. Okay, what about the other two functions? So what about the discontinuities of the characteristic function on Q? So the function that's one for the rational points and zero for all the irrational points. So there are two things going on, right? Either rational points or irrational points. So let's look at them separately. If we look at a rational point, I claim it's not continuous there, right? Because I can take any point, I can find a point that's arbitrarily close to it whose value is zero, okay? So it's not continuous, it does not approach one. And what about an irrational point. If I take an irrational point where the value is already zero, well, I can find rational points that are arbitrarily close to that. So again, it's not continuous. So this one is discontinuous everywhere. Okay, just every point. All right, but that is different from the Tome function. So what about the Tome function? So let's see where that one is discontinuous. So this function here, right, so if I look at a half, for example, right, it's discontinuous there, right, because I can, and I take a point that's nearby, I have a different value. And what about here at a third? So when I take a point nearby, I have a different value. So it's discontinuous there, it's discontinuous here. Okay, but what about if I take some irrational point here? So then if I'm close enough, then the difference is less than, let me see, a point like here is pretty clear. Then the difference is less than 1 over n. If I'm even closer, it's less than 1 over n squared, et cetera. So I can always find a small enough epsilon so that it's close. So this one is continuous at the points that are irrational and discontinuous only at the rational points. Okay, so that's a substantial difference between the two functions, and it really does sort of explain why one of them is integrable and the other one's not. Okay, so let me cut that down. So finally, the discontinuity points for the Tome function are just the rational points between 0 and 1. Okay, any questions about the notion of discontinuity points? Okay, so I want to add one more theorem and then a corollary of that theorem to give us another collection of functions that are Riemann integrable, and then state the theorem, but that I won't prove, which is the general answer. All right, so let's see, this is 11.50. And it says the following. If I have a collection of, if I have a function which is bounded, on AB, and I know that for every, actually, let me use 0 and 1, that's just because it's slightly easier. I'll just use 0 and 1. That would be true for any such interval. Whenever I look not at the entire interval, but something where I cut off 0. So for all epsilon greater than 0, we have that if I restrict my function f and just look at points, values of x that are at least epsilon, so I cut off the little bit around 0, then this is Riemann integrable. Okay. Then I have that, in fact, the entire function all the way over to 0 is also Riemann integrable. Okay. So if I look back at my examples over here, does that theorem going to enable me to show that either f or g here is Riemann integrable?
I think it shows that f is Riemann integrable.
Yes, you're correct. And right, because if we start here at epsilon and go up to 1, what do I know about this function here once I restrict it to numbers that are at least epsilon?
It's a continuous function, so then it's exactly Riemann integrable.
That's right. So it follows from up here. So this is then a Riemann integrable function in here. And so we can use our theorem to say that, in fact, even though my function is not continuous at 0, I still get that it is a Riemann integrable function. Okay, so that's how you use this function, this theorem. Hence, f of x above, I'll just write that again, sine 1 on x, is Riemann integrable. Since f restricted to epsilon 1 is continuous. And hence, Riemann integrable. OK, question for that. All right, so let me just prove it then. And then you can try to think about how to use it. I claim that g is also Riemann integrable. Actually, so why can't I just apply this theorem immediately to get that g works? Right, this one has all these singularities in here. This is not continuous when I restrict it from epsilon to 1. Right, it's got all these singularities. So that one I can't quite do yet. But it will follow from this term together with the corollary. All right, so hence we have that. And so let me just run through the proof now. So proof from, okay. So let's see. So we know that our function is bounded. So let me just give a name to its size. So write, M for this for the soup norm. Okay. This is finite because M is bounded. Sorry, F is bounded. Okay. All right. And now I'm going to use the fact that I have an integrable function whenever I restrict to epsilon to 1. Okay. And what does it, being an integrable function, tell me? It says that I can find a partition so that when I take the upper integral and I take the lower integral, they differ by just a small amount, right? They are a good approximation to the area under that curve. All right, so let me write that out. So for every epsilon greater than 0, I'm going to choose a partition. And it's going to be, actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to stop not at epsilon, I'm going to stop at epsilon over m, just because it's going to make my life a little easier later on. I can choose any number there, and that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to start at epsilon over m, just for convenience. So this is going to be a partition of the interval, not all the way from 0, but from epsilon over m up to 1, okay? So it's a partition there, chopped it up, but I stop here at epsilon over m, okay? And go up to 1. Since my function is integrable from epsilon over m to 1, I can find an approximation so that when I take the upper and lower approximations using p, they're close. And so if I take a f, and of course I have to restrict it, and then use this partition p, and compare that to the lower estimate that I get using that partition of the same function, the restriction to epsilon over m to 1, with again the partition p. Well, since it's integrable, I can get a good approximation, and by good, I'm going to say that this is less than epsilon. Okay. I'm going to choose a p that gives me that. All right. Well, now if I just draw my picture here, so I have this epsilon over m, and I have 0, and I have my partition p here, and I have 1. Okay. So this is my you're doing a different color here. So the black part there, that's my partition P, right? So this is P. And if I want now a partition of the entire thing, I can just add 0 to it. I'll do that. So write P hat for P where I just throw in 0. Okay, so now I have added one more interval. Just this one extra interval here. And so that makes it a partition now from 0 to 1. Okay, and I've added just one more piece to it. All right, and now I'm just going to use that one and get my estimate and compute. All right, so I'd like to show that the difference between L and U of F is small, and then I'll be done, right? So let's compute. So we're going to take U of F minus L of F, and I want that to be less than epsilon. Actually, I mean less than 3 epsilon. So that's good enough, okay? So let me do that computation. So this is less than or equal to 2. All right, well, I can choose my partition. So I can take the upper approximation of f using this partition. And I've just given myself a partition. So I'm going to use it, this p hat here. And then I'm going to subtract off what I get using the lower estimate and the partition p hat again. Okay. All right, and now I can just split this up and see what I get. Because I have actually put it less than because I now have two things going on. I have the interval, this new interval here, and then I have all this. This is just my old stuff that I had before. So let me start with this new one. So that one's going to give me one piece, and it's got a width, right, which is the distance between epsilon over m and 0. Right, so that's the width of that. Okay, and what's the greatest height that this box can have? If I take the sup or the inf, right, those are going to be bounded by plus or minus m, right? Those are the biggest and smallest that can be, because that's the size within which my function lives, right? So that's the biggest that can be. I'll just write it out carefully. So this is the sup of over x between 0 and epsilon over m of f of x minus the inf. So that's from the u and the l terms. Okay, but those are at most m and minus m respectively. So we're going to get at most 2m. And then I can add whatever happened before. And so that's just exactly what I had before. So this will be u of f restricted to epsilon on m, comma 1 with partition p and l. Epsilon m to 1 with partition p. So that's just, actually, I guess this is with equality. Let me write the equals. I didn't end up doing any approximations. Okay, so that's exactly correct. Okay, but now let me do the approximation. So let's see, the epsilon over m minus 0, that one's easy, that's just epsilon over m. Okay, the soup. So what's the biggest the soup can be? It's m, right? And so this is going to be an m minus negative m. So this is going to be 2m is the biggest that that soup minus the inf can be. All right, and then I have the u minus l, but that I have from up above here is at most epsilon. So this is plus epsilon. And so I am done. So the difference between u and l is less than epsilon for every epsilon, and therefore zero. So f is remanageable. Zero. Okay, any question about that proof? All right, then let me get one corollary and then see if you can use those the theorem and the corollary to show that G is in fact Riemann integrable. So let me note the following corollary. And this is also in the text 11.53. And it says the following, if I have just a finite collection of discontinuities of places where my function is not continuous, then the function is Riemann integrable. So if we have a bounded function, and the set of discontinuities is finite, then the function is Riemann integrable. Okay, so I think I'll just skip this proof, but is it clear what you would use to prove this? Okay, so I have this finite set of places where my function is discontinuous. So what I'm gonna do is I'm gonna use this theorem 11.50 here, right, to get, from here to the one that includes that point. And then I'm gonna do that from the other side. And then I'm gonna use 11.44 to say that if it's integrable here and it's integrable here, then it's integrable in the whole thing. And then I'm gonna do it again. So it's integrable here and here, whole thing, here and here, whole thing. And since it's finite, I'm gonna have to do it finite many times. That's a very, very brief sketch, but let me know if you have a question. So use proposition 11.50 and, the proposition. Anyway, it's 11.44. So that one is the one that allows me to stick together integrable functions and get a new integrable function on the union. Okay, so let me just give you a few minutes here to try in breakout rooms to show that G above, G of X as above. Yeah, what do you think? If you have any questions, sine of 1 over x and 0 is Riemann integrable using both 11.50 and 11.53. Okay, so both the theorem that I just proved together with its corollary. All right, so give you a few minutes. Okay, let's see. So did anyone get that to work?
It looks like we have a discontinuity every time x is equal to 1 over n pi, right? Which we have like an infinite amount of those as we approach 0. But as long as we cut 0 off, right, for any for all epsilon greater than 0, we should have a finite amount of those discontinuities.
Correct.
And then once we have those finite amount of discontinuities, we can use 11.53 to say that it will be Riemann integrable. Correct. And then we can use 11.50 to say that it's integrable from 0 to 1.
Okay. Okay, did everyone see that? So as he points out, it's when we restrict to any interval starting at epsilon where we cut 0 off, then there are only finitely many of these discontinuous points left. There are infinitely many overall, but they bunch up around 0. So as long as we cut off the bit around 0, then we have only finitely many left. And so that puts us in 11.53. So each one of those is itself Riemann integrable. And that puts us in 11.50 that says, therefore, the entire thing is integrable. Okay, so that gives us an example that we couldn't previously have shown was Riemann integrable. Okay, any questions about those two, that theorem and its corollary?
If we had like, if like there are an countable number of discontinuities, could we extend this, like to say that, like then f is Riemann integrable?
Yes. It is. Let me write the final theorem, which I'm not going to prove. But yes, that is true. And in fact, that you could even prove. The final theorem is actually a little bit trickier. And I'm only going to write it partially, but you can let me write it, and then you can see if you have further questions about that. So. So here's a theorem, which is, it is in the text, although they don't actually prove it, but of course you can look up the proof elsewhere. So it says that there is a set of sets. So there is a collection Z. Of subsets of an interval AB, and Z stands for zero, so zero measure sets, called zero measure, so that if I have a bounded function F, then to tell whether it's Riemann integrable, all I have to do is see whether it's a set of discontinuities falls within Z. Then F is a Riemann integrable, if and only if there's a bunch of discontinuity for F are in Z. Okay, so in other words, studying where it's discontinuous is enough information to tell you whether it's Riemann integrable. Okay, so that's a theorem, and I hope it just sort of motivates what we've been looking at. And then to the point that you are asking, I note, and in fact, this is something you could prove. I didn't turn into a homework problem. If you have a countable set, then it is in fact Riemann integrable. So all countable sets are in Z. So every countable subset of the interval AB is in Z. But there are others. Okay, and it's kind of fun to work out facts about what they are and whatnot, but that's really material for a Measure 3 course, so and we'll not say anything more about it. The text says a little bit more and gives you a nice example. Maybe I'll just give it its name. We'll say that. E.g., the Cantor set. Cantor set. Okay, so so there are examples, and there are some fairly explicit ones even of sets that can be discontinuity sets, and you'll still get something that's Riemann integral. But it's a little bit complicated to identify whether a set is a zero measure or not. As I said, it's the material for a Measure 3 course. I think that's 205. All right, so any other questions then? That's all that I wanted to say about which functions are exactly Riemann integrable and which are not. So if there are no further, so now will be the time to ask if you have questions about that. Otherwise, what I'm going to do is start in on the fundamental theorem of calculus, so the relationship between integrals and derivatives. So so this is a section 12. No fundamental theorem of calculus, which of course is the reason that we looked at integrals to begin with. We were really interested in derivatives, and so we now need to go back and see why these two things are related. Okay, and of course, you already had class on this, Math 21 focuses quite a lot on the fundamental theorem of calculus. So let me just recall where that, an example of that. And of course, the type of question we're going to ask here is just how generally does it hold? So for which functions can you get these fundamental theorems of calculus to work? And it'll be you know, more than the ones that worked in Math 21, where you restricted to ones that you could do explicitly. But there are functions where it doesn't. So you have to be a little bit careful. All right, and for that, to that end, let me just give a bit of notation. Definition. If I have an integrable function, on the interval AB, then I'm going to write J of F for the new function, and if I evaluate that new function at x, this is just the integral from a to x of f of y to y. Okay, so I'm just going to write down basically the integral, I'm just giving it a name, calling it j, just like I called the derivative capital D. All right, and so just a couple of notes. So let's see, so why do I know that is a well-defined function? All right, so what do I need? Well, I'm trying to integrate this function from a to x. So what I need is that the restriction of f to the interval from a to x is still integrable. Since f restricted to the interval ax is integrable by 11.44. Okay, so we already saw that that's true. Okay, so it's well defined. Let's see, what else can we say about it? So what about its value at a? Exactly. So, if I just integrate from a to a, so I've got my function here, and I'm computing its area from here to here, that's going to be just zero, right? There's no, no area there. So that one's at zero. So it started at zero. And I can also bound it elsewhere. J, f at x is bounded, right? So the largest it could be is I'm integrating from 0 up to x, so it's going to be the length here, sorry, from a up to x, so the length here, x minus a, times the maximum value that it can have, and that maximum value is going to be the soup, which goes under the name soup norm. Okay, so in particular, this is again a bounded function. So we're back in the world of bounded functions. So that's the function we're going to look at, and that's the one we'd like to be the inverse to the derivative. Let me just do a quick example so that I hope the notation is clear. So e.g., a basic function that you would have seen in Math 21, if I take f of x to be x squared, and I try applying these things to it. So what is the fundamental theorem of Socrates supposed to tell me? It says that if I take the, so remember the d of f meant the derivative, so that's x squared prime, which is to say 2x. And j of f, is it clear what this is? It's basically sort of tracking through the notation. So what is j f of x? Is it clear what that means? No, I should have said what interval I'm in. Let me work in 0, 1. All right, so then what is this J going to be?
It's the integral of x squared from 0 to x.
Exactly, right. And we know the integral from previous studies, right? So that's 1/3 dot x cubed. So that's going to be, and I'll write it out, it said integral from 0 to x of y squared dy. And so that is 1/3 x cubed. All right, and but what we're interested in is applying one of them and then the other, and seeing if they're inverses to each other. If I take, therefore, djf, okay, so I take the derivative of 1/3 x cubed, then I'm going to get x squared back, which is to say I'm back at x. So d inverts j. And also the other way around. And those are two separate facts, and we're going to prove them separately. So you can also take first the derivative and then take the integral, right? And so if I take the derivative first, then I have this 2x, and then I'm going to integrate that. And again, I'm going to get x squared back. So in this case, both dj and jd bring you back to the function you started at. And so we're interested in which functions that's true for. Okay, so that's what we're aiming for. So the question is, for which functions? F do we get these two facts, that if I first integrate and then differentiate, I get my function back, and the second one is that if I first differentiate and then integrate, then I get my function back. Okay. All right, so that's where we're headed. Let me get started. I just have time for one of the theorems, so we won't get very far. But let me at least get started. The first thing to note is that if I start with a function, I don't get an arbitrary one out of J, I get one more thing. So actually we've already seen one restriction. It starts out at 0 and we know that it's bounded, but more is true, and that is that it's continuous. So that's a theorem 12.6, all right? And so that says that if we have things as above, so if f is a Riemann integrable function on AB, and we do exactly what we did above, we take its integral, then this JF is not just starting at 0 and bounded, but it's also a continuous function. Okay, so to show that something is continuous, I need to show that the limit from the right and the left are the same and equal to the value. So we need to show that if I take the limit as a, let me write it as h goes to zero from the right of my function j f evaluated at x plus h, then that is jf evaluated at x. And I guess I should put in my quantifiers for all x in AB. Right, so I want to show this, and of course also from the left. Okay, so those two facts. Let me just focus on the first one. So the other one, of course, is similar. So let me do this first one. So the limit as h goes to zero from the right. Okay, so now I can rewrite this j, right? So j is the integral. So this is the integral from x to x plus h. Oh, sorry. Right. Let me rewrite it slightly. So what I have here is actually the integral from a to x plus h. So let me write it that way correctly. A to x plus h, right? Of f of y dy. And I'm curious whether this is equal to the integral from a to x of f of y dy. So what I'm going to do is subtract that integral of this right-hand side from both sides and see if I'm getting zero. Okay, so we want the limit of h goes to zero from the right of the integral from a to x plus h of this f minus the integral from a to x of f. And what I'm curious about is whether that goes to zero. Okay, but that just leaves this left-hand side is equal to the limit as h goes to zero from the right of the integral from x up to x plus h of f of y dy. Okay. Okay, but now we can bound this. So this is less than equal to, all right, so the width of my interval, which is just x plus h minus x. So I'll just write it as h, that's what it is. So there's the width of the interval, which is h, and then the maximum value that we can achieve. So that's the supernorm of f. All right. And, oh, and I dropped my limit, sorry. I'll put it back. So this is the limit. H goes to zero from the right, okay. And so then that, of course, is zero. And so the limit from the left is similar. Okay, so so not only when we take this interval do we get functions that are bounded, we get really nice ones. They're continuous. Okay, and that's going to tell us something about whether we can differentiate. Now, of course, remember, continuous isn't quite enough to differentiate, right? So it's so we have to be careful if we want to be able to first take this integral, take this integral and then differentiate and get back where we started. We have to make sure that it's possible to differentiate. Okay, so there are going to be some functions where we're going to have a problem. In any case, next time we will finish this up and figure out for exactly which functions we can get these two forms of the fundamental thermodynamic calculus. I'll turn off the recording and stick around. Enjoy the weekend.